Welcome to the November 2, 2007 episode of SCOTUSCast. On October 31st, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments for Danforth v. Minnesota. The court was asked to consider whether state Supreme Courts are required to use a standard announced in Teague v. Lane to determine whether United States Supreme Court decisions apply retroactively to state court criminal cases, or may a state court apply state law or state constitution-based retroactivity tests that afford application of Supreme Court decisions to a broader class of criminal defendants than the class defined by Teague. In this episode of SCOTUSCast, Professor Stephen McAllister of Kansas University Law School discusses this case. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no particular stance on legal or policy issues. All matters of opinion are those of the speakers. And now, Professor McAllister of Kansas University Law School.
In Danforth v. Minnesota, number 06-8273, a case argued on October 31, 2007, the Supreme Court takes up a question of its own retroactivity doctrine. In particular, the court in 1989, in a case called Teague v. Lane, held that in federal habeas corpus proceedings, new rules that had been announced by the court would not be applied as a general matter in federal habeas corpus proceedings. The court, of course, developed two exceptions to Teague, the watershed rule of criminal procedure, and also a rule that now puts conduct off limits from prosecution. But those exceptions over time have proven extremely rare. So the Teague is a very strong doctrine of non-retroactivity in federal habeas corpus proceedings. The question in Danforth v. Minnesota is whether the Teague retroactivity, or you might say non-retroactivity doctrine, is compelled on state courts or to be followed by state courts in their own post-conviction proceedings. Teague itself, of course, was developed in the context of federal habeas corpus litigation. But in Danforth, the petitioner, the defendant in the case, had raised a Crawford v. Washington Confrontation Clause challenge. He then pursued that in Minnesota's state courts in a post-conviction proceeding, but when the case got to the Minnesota Supreme Court, that court held that it was bound to follow the Teague retroactivity doctrine and did not think Crawford would apply retroactively. Its prediction was correct. The Supreme Court later agreed with that proposition. And so Danforth sought review in the Supreme Court of the United States on the what might appear to be technical question of whether Teague applies to state court proceedings. As it turns out in the argument on October 31st, it's a question that it touches a nerve, apparently, with the justices and with the court, and raises some fundamental questions about constitutional rights and remedies, substantive law, federal common law, and other interesting, and as Justice Breyer described it at one point, metaphysical, even, propositions. The petitioner in the case is the defendant, the criminal defendant, and his arguments are, in essence, that the Teague Doctrine is at most a remedial sort of rule, that it is not part of the substance of any constitutional right that the court announces. Rather, it's a remedial rule the court has developed in the context of federal habeas corpus and should basically be limited to the context of federal habeas corpus, not compelled or to be followed by the states. And there are many aspects to the petitioner's arguments, but fundamentally he argues that Teague sets a floor for state court retroactivity. In other words, if Teague says something is retroactive, then the state courts have to give effect to that. But they may go beyond that and find things to be applied retroactively that Teague itself would not apply retroactively. The respondent's arguments, the state of Minnesota in this case, are that Teague really is part and parcel of defining the substance of constitutional rights, that you cannot distinguish here between rights and remedies. And if it's really part of the substantive constitutional ruling, say in a case like Crawford v. Washington, when that ruling applies and to whom it will apply, the respondent would argue, is all part of the substance of the right, the confrontation right, that the court's creating in the first place. And therefore, as a matter of supremacy clause and respect for the Supreme Court and its decisions, state courts are bound to follow Teague in their own post-conviction proceedings. The respondent also argues that if state courts want to give, in essence, a greater retroactive effect in a Teague-type situation, they need to do it as a matter of state law. So look to their own confrontation clause under their state constitution, adopt a rule like Crawford, and decide that it does apply retroactively. In their view, that will serve the federalism interests that are present in this case. There are amici states on both sides of this case, or actually at least in two different respects. The state of Alaska wrote an amicus brief that supports the respondent, the state of Minnesota, arguing that at a minimum, Teague is federal common law that effectively preempts state law and is binding on state courts. The state of Kansas wrote an amicus brief arguing that Teague is not binding on state courts and that, in fact, state courts don't have to have post-conviction proceedings at all if they choose not to. Or, in fact, they can limit the kinds of constitutional, federal constitutional claims that can even be raised in state court proceedings. The arguments which were held on October 31st are quite interesting for what they reveal about the court's perception of the case and its importance. Far from viewing it as a technical, narrow kind of question, the justices seem to wrestle with much bigger issues, including the distinction between constitutional rights and remedies for violations of rights, including the question whether this is a substantive rule of constitutional law, Teague itself, or whether it's federal common law, or whether it's really a gloss on federal habeas corpus statutes. The questioning was quite active, quite vigorous, and if one looks carefully at the transcript, a not unfamiliar pattern seems to emerge, with probably four justices somewhat sympathetic to Danforth's claim that maybe the states have some leeway to adopt a more generous retroactivity doctrine. Those four would be Justices Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, and others very skeptical that the state courts could in any way depart from the Teague rule, and that would have seemed to include the Chief Justice and Justice Scalia, certainly. And notably, perhaps Justice Kennedy. He did ask some questions on both sides, but Justice Kennedy seemed skeptical of the proposition that states could simply adopt their own retroactivity doctrine, something different than Teague itself. Ultimately, whether the court's ruling in Danforth versus Minnesota will be broad or narrow is, of course, anyone's guess. But given the nature and tenor of the oral argument, as well as the various arguments presented by the parties and amici, many of which spin out different variations of the problems in this case, one could easily imagine this case taking a while to come out in the form of opinions, and that there may well be several different viewpoints expressed in those opinions that will ultimately perhaps tell us more about the court's view of its Teague doctrine, which in turn will suggest perhaps things about the court's view of itself and its own role, obviously, in our system and in interpreting the Constitution, as well as perhaps some federalism implications in terms of the relationship between the state courts and state post-conviction proceedings and the federal courts and federal habeas corpus.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org. /multimedia.